The topic of the talk is Rabbi Jacob Joseph, Chief Rabbi of New York.
First?
He was the first and he was the only. Well, he was sort of the only. We'll hear how he was and wasn't the only. First of all, let's back up a little bit and have a little bit of a review about Jewish immigration to America. The majority of the first Jews who came to America were from Spanish, were of Spanish-Portuguese origin. They came starting in 1654, and the majority of Jews that came through the 17th century and into the beginning of the 18th century were Spanish-Portuguese. There were some Bavarian Jews and some other Jews, but the majority were Spanish-Portuguese, and in fact, that's why all of the synagogues that were first founded in America were based on the Spanish-Portuguese ritual, not the what's called the Ashkenazic ritual, which came later. In fact, the first Ashkenazic synagogue was in New York, I think in about 1820-something. After that, Jews from Germany began to come. And as is typical of groups, the Spanish-Portuguese looked down upon the Jews from Germany. They weren't at all happy with them. They felt they were uncouth. After all, the Spanish-Portuguese Jews had been professionals in Spain and Portugal. They had resisted secretly, anyway, the Inquisition, and they looked down upon them. But then, beginning in the middle of the 19th century, Jews from other parts of Europe began to come, and particularly in 1881 began a huge immigration from Eastern Europe, from Russia, as a result of pogroms, as a result of attacks on Jews. And between 1881 and 1924, over 2 million Jews came to the United States. They stopped in 1924 because the immigration quotas were imposed, and they couldn't get in. And this meant, and many of them, by the way, concentrated in the New York area, and the situation in New York was chaotic. By the way, it's interesting that the German Jews, once they became acclimated to America, when the Russians came, they weren't happy with them at all. Just as the Portuguese weren't happy with the Germans weren't happy with the Russians, and in fact, there were attempts in certain places, in particular in Baltimore, to raise money to send Russian Jews back to Russia. They didn't want them. Anyway, this situation here in New York was somewhat chaotic in terms of the Jewish community, and a number of synagogues got together and decided that what New York needed was a chief rabbi. In particular, one of the main concerns was the supervision of kosher meat, which was just simply unregulated, And the person who ended up coming was a gentleman by the name of Rabbi Jacob Joseph. Joseph, by the way, is his last name. Rabbi Jacob Joseph. Now, Rabbi Jacob, actually his European name was Josepha. He was better known as Rabbi Jacob. Joseph was born in Lithuania in 1840 into a very poor family. His father worked in a brewery. His father scrimped and saved because Rabbi Jacob Joseph, from an early age, displayed a brilliance in his Talmudic studies. And so his father scrimped and saved so that he could continue his studies, the son could continue his studies in yeshiva. And in particular, he studied in what was called the famous Volozhin Yeshiva under Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. That's 1817 to 1893. And later he became one of the chief disciples of Rabbi Yisrael, or Israel Salanta, who I spoke about a while ago, who was the founder of something called the Musa movement. Rabbi Salanta, or Lipkin actually was his last name, Salanta was where he spent a lot of his time, is 1810 to 1883. Rabbi Joseph had a dynamic personality, and just like his master, Rabbi Israel Salanta, he couldn't seem to stay in one place for very long. And he moved to various places, and in 1883, He ended up in Vilna, and Vilna was known as the Jerusalem of Lithuania. It had a very active Jewish community, a community filled with Talmudic scholars, and he became a very popular preacher there. And thousands flocked to hear him speak. He published the book of his sermons, and they show that he was a man with an orderly mind and a liberal outlook. The sermons were clear, they were well constructed, and they had an ethical emphasis. However, he had too much confidence in certain people, and he got involved financially with some people, and he ended up being bankrupt. He was absolutely bankrupt. He was penniless. And this affected him mentally, and in fact, he almost lost his mind. He became, at one point, a very melancholic, and he would spend hours in the old Jewish cemetery in Vilna weeping. Let's leave him for the moment, but you can see clearly that he wanted to get out of this state of poverty and how he would be interested in going somewhere where he would better himself. In 1879, 32 New York congregations met and decided that they wanted to offer the position of chief rabbi. Now, chief rabbi is not something that's generic to America. In England, you have a chief rabbi. In Europe, in many of the cities, you had a chief rabbi of the city. But America has never really had this concept of chief rabbi. But these people felt that if they had a chief rabbi, he would be able to organize the community and bring some sort of sensibility to the chaos that was going on. They offered it to one person. He's known as the Malbim. He was a famous commentator on the Bible, but he died before he could actually reply whether he was going to come to America or not. Between 1881 and 1885, over 50,000 Jews came to the United States, and many of them ended up here in New York. So New York became a bustling Jewish community.
Which did?
New York.
Which part?
Which part? The Lower East Side, primarily. The Lower East Side was where most of the Jews ended up settling.
You know that at that time, we think of the Lower East Side as a Jewish community, but at that time, it was known as Klein Deutschland, Little Germany.
Yes.
And the many German socialists had already settled there.
Yes.
And they were the mentors of Jewish socialists.
Yes, and in addition, there was an Irish immigration there. This was a starting point for ethnic immigration. People moved here. Yes, yes. It was decided that to bring order, you need a chief rabbi. And a group of synagogues, of prominent congregations, they formed something called the Association of American Orthodox Hebrew Congregations. This was in 1887, and each of the synagogues pledged a certain amount of money to support a chief rabbi. The position was offered to a couple of other people. They turned it down, and finally it was offered to Rabbi Jacob Joseph. And he accepted the position. Now, let's keep in mind that Rabbi Jacob Joseph was a traditionally trained Talmudic scholar with no secular education per se, with no knowledge of the German language or of the English language, two things that were common here in America at the time. Many Jews spoke German, many Jews spoke English. He spoke Yiddish. So at a meeting on December 7th, 1887, Rabbi Jacob Joseph was elected chief rabbi with an annual salary of $2,500. That's a huge sum in those days. That's big money, okay? For an initial period of 6 years. In addition, he was to be provided with an apartment suitable for a chief rabbi, and that apartment was to be furnished. In the letter informing him of his election, the association also undertook to provide traveling expenses for him and his family and to grant him an advance that he requested because he wanted to pay off the debts he had in Europe. So they actually sent him money up front. It took some time to get the money together, But eventually it was put together, an apartment was rented, and the association announced that there was a chief rabbi coming. They outlined his duties. Chief rabbi arrived on January 7th, 1888. He sailed on the Aller, a ship, and guess what port he came into? Came into Hoboken. Hoboken was a major port. In fact, during the 19th century, there was a competition between New York and Hoboken as to which port would be the major port on the East Coast in this area. He sailed in on early Saturday morning, July 7th, 1888. The ship Aller, on which Rabbi Jacob Joseph was sailing, reached its American port, Hoboken, New Jersey. Now, you're not allowed, according to Jewish ritual law, to leave a ship on the Sabbath. So you're allowed to be on the ship, but you're not allowed to debark.
Even if it's sinking?
If it's sinking, of course. Saving one's life takes precedence over everything. But the ship was not sinking. So he stayed on ship until the Sabbath was over, and then he left the ship. As soon as the Sabbath was over, many people boarded the ferry from New York to Hoboken in order to greet the new chief rabbi. Stevedores at the port of Hoboken, these are quotes, by the way, from articles that were written at the time, from people, stevedores at the port of Hoboken, New Jersey, were amazed to see some 10,000 bearded Orthodox Jews waiting to greet Rabbi Joseph upon his arrival. Mr. Draman Jones of Congregation Beis HaMedrash HaGadol, that was the main congregation, the biggest, the most powerful congregation in New York City at the time, headed the delegation that had come to greet the new chief rabbi. He welcomed Rabbi Joseph by offering him bread and salt, and then recited the traditional benediction upon seeing a great scholar. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has imparted of thy wisdom to those who revere thee. And then he added the special blessing that what's called Shechionu, that we had reached this time. Then introduced Rabbi Jacob Joseph, he made some brief remarks, and then he was taken by carriage to Mayor's Hotel. I don't think it's here anymore in Hoboken. As far as I know, it's not. He spent the night. Then Sunday morning, he was taken to Manhattan, the Lower East Side, to his new residence, with a huge amount of pomp and circumstance. When the procession escorting him reached the house at Henry and Jefferson Streets, thousands upon thousands of Jews milled about. Police had been called earlier. There were some curiosity seekers, but the crowd was composed almost entirely of East European immigrant Jews who felt that the arrival of Rabbi Joseph marked the beginning of a spiritual revival for American Jewry and a new deal for the disregarded and despised Russian Jew. Because again, the Germans looked down upon the Russians, other groups looked down upon the Russians. It was with great pride that the Jews of the Lower East Side learned of the article on the chief rabbi's arrival, which appeared in the New York Herald on July 8th. The only such dignitary in this country, this important American newspaper called him, further disclosing that he was till recently in charge of the largest synagogue in Vilna, in Lithuania. Everything seemed great. He was welcomed with pomp and circumstance. It seemed that he could only continue to go higher from here. But there were clouds brewing. I was there as vice president. This is a quote from Rabbi Judah David Eisenstein, who lived to be over 100, who was a prolific writer about the history, the Jewish history of New York and America. He wrote in one of his many, many books, I was there as vice president of the synagogue on the Sabbath when he delivered his first drasha, his first speech. Concerning his sermon, he did not succeed fully in moving the hearers here. Even though in Vilna he had preached so eloquently to the congregation that he had brought tears to those who heard his voice speaking of ethics which flow from a pure heart. Of course, his language style used in preaching was Lithuanian. Now, let's understand something. Most of the Jews spoke Yiddish. However, there are various pronunciations of Yiddish depending upon where Jews came from. The pronunciation of a Lithuanian Jew of Yiddish is different from that of a Russian Jew, which is different from that of a Jew from Galiciana, from Galicia. So he spoke, of course, a Lithuanian Yiddish. He said, of course, his language style used in his preaching was Lithuanian without any order, and he mixed together a good bit of nonsense with a little subtle argumentation and points of scripture. He hurt the ears of the intelligent listeners who were accustomed to preachers whose sermons were delivered clearly in pure English or German, and therefore they didn't think much of him. Not a very positive response to his first speech. This was merely the beginning of the woes that Rabbi Jacob Joseph was to experience in his role as chief rabbi of New York. There was trouble ahead for the new chief rabbi, real trouble. He encountered opposition. However, from the outset, the appointment of Rabbi Joseph by the Association of American Orthodox Hebrew Congregations created a furor among certain Jewish circles. Many Orthodox congregations did not partake in the selection, and they refused to recognize his leadership. Reform Jewry, on the other hand, remained indifferent or hostile to the entire idea of a chief rabbi. As far as they were concerned, what did you need such a person? Jacob Joseph's appointment was particularly resented by the Anglo-Jewish press, then dominated by German Jews. Thus, the New York correspondent of Isaac Meir Weiss's American Israelite, Isaac Meir Weiss is in the forefront of Reform Judaism, even before Rabbi Joseph's arrival in America, expressed bemusement that a man who spoke neither German nor English and whose vernacular was an unintelligible jargon, they looked down upon the speaking of Yiddish, he spoke Yiddish, had been chosen as a fitting representative of the Orthodox Judaism to the world at large. Others questioned the entire concept of a chief rabbi. What is the chief rabbi to do, had already been asked in December 1887 by the perceptive New York correspondent of the American Israelite, Miodea. He stated that even those most eager for the creation of this new office did not quite know what its function was to be. To render ritual decisions, he was not needed. There were plenty of other rabbis here, and there were plenty of preachers. And it seemed highly unlikely that the congregations would import a chief rabbi just to sit and study day and night. What do we need an immigrant and prejudiced rabbi? Asked the Reform periodical Jewish Tidings. He should go back to the land that gave him birth. In a later issue, the argument was carried further. Rabbi Joseph is unfamiliar with the language of this country and is therefore unfitted to exercise authority or influence over American Jews. The Jews of this country do not need a grand rabbi and one from a foreign country. One who is reared amongst the prejudices and bigotries of Eastern countries will certainly prove an obstacle to the people over whom he is expected to exercise control. So he met opposition, first of all, from the non-Orthodox, and he met opposition also from even within the Orthodox circle, because those who were not part of this group that had chosen him weren't happy with it. But what really killed him was a penny per chicken. A penny per chicken killed him. What do I mean by that? The situation with kosher meat and poultry in New York was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. There were many, many supervisions. There were those who didn't have supervisions. By the way, the kosher meat business can be very lucrative financially. It is prone to abuses of unscrupulous people. If you can take non-kosher meat or non-kosher fowl and sell it as kosher, you make big, big money. And the association that had brought the chief rabbi here felt that he should set up, in fact, that's what they wanted. They wanted to set up a supervision system in which he would bring order to this madness. He would hire other rabbis to work with him who would inspect, who would check what was going on and make sure that what was supposed to be kosher was really kosher. They looked upon the chief rabbi also as a cash cow, in the sense that from the supervision, from the fees charged for supervision, they would be able to pay his salary, they would be able to run the organization. Rabbi Joseph was opposed to any fee for kosher supervision. He felt that the congregations themselves should underwrite it, and he was opposed to it. They wanted to charge a fee, and finally he got them to agree to a compromise. namely that for every chicken that was slaughtered under the supervision of the chief rabbinate, they would add a penny to the price of the chicken. A penny. Now, a penny was big money in 1888, 1890. That was real money. That wasn't nothing. And so that was what was set up. A penny for the supervision. And to show that the chicken had been slaughtered under the supervision of the chief rabbi, there's something called a lead seal, a plumba that was attached to the chicken. And that the housewife had to pay a penny for. They totally misunderstood how this would be received. Most kosher consumers looked upon this as price gouging. After all, they hadn't had to pay for it before. Now they had to pay for it. Those who were from Russia looked upon it as a tax similar to what the Tsar imposed upon the Jews in Russia. The socialists and those and reformers who didn't anyway care about kosher were absolutely opposed to this. And the opposition was tremendous, tremendous. Completely out of bounds of what they had anticipated. Many were opposed to it. In addition, some of the rabbis who had been given supervision previously were threatened with a loss of their income, and of course they were opposed to it. And the butchers themselves felt that the best supervision was no supervision because they could do whatever they wanted. So opposition to the association to Rabbi Jacob Joseph also came from a number of Galician and Hungarian congregations who were unwilling to submit to an authority dominated by what are called the Litvaks, the Lithuanians. Those Jews who were not from Lithuania, and he, Rabbi Joseph, was from Lithuania, were opposed to somebody being chief rabbi from Lithuania. So what did they do? Instead, they decided to look for a chief rabbi of their own. And in 1892, they settled on Rabbi Joshua Siegel as their choice. What followed was a squalid competition between the two quote-unquote chief rabbis and their partisans over the supervision of kosher meat. In 1893, still another rabbi entered the fray. His name was Chaim Vidrowitz of Moscow. He managed to gather to his side a few followers from a number of Hasidic small prayer houses, and he hung out a sign reading, Chief Rabbi in America. When he was asked who gave him the title of Chief Rabbi, he replied, the sign painter. The sign painter, he said. Rabbi Joseph, despite a small and appreciative following, could not overcome the centrifugal forces in the New York Jewish community. Reduced to shame and parody, his influence gradually declined. Furthermore, the association soon began to renege on payments of his salary and for all practical purposes became a mere paper organization. Rabbi Joseph was reduced to living in poverty. They stopped paying his salary. A contemporary wrote, the rabbi was left without any income and is in dire straits and there is nothing that can be done with him now. He and his whole family are in very serious difficulties. Reduced to abject poverty, Rabbi Joseph was forced to move his family to a squalid Lower East Side tenement flat. To Rabbi Joseph's financial distress was added physical illness. He was confined to his bed and invalid the rest of his life. The community that had once hailed him now completely neglected him. Forgotten was all he had done to elevate the position of East European Jew, and to establish dignity and integrity in the religious institutions which served him. All but forgotten, he lay on his bed of pain, remembering what had been and musing, no doubt, on what could have been. At the end of July 1902, the chief rabbi once again became the topic of discussion. On the 28th of July, he breathed his last, and the headlines announced his demise the next day. He died at 62 after a five-year confinement to his bed because of paralysis. And now, all of a sudden, the Jewish community woke up. The chief rabbi died. They became so concerned. They became, like, all of a sudden, they had forgotten about him. But they decided that he needed a magnificent funeral. They needed to provide him with a huge funeral. And Jews wanted to come. Word of the rabbi's death spread rapidly throughout the Lower East Side, and the very people who ignored him while he lived felt obligated to honor him in his death. There was an unprecedented outpouring of grief from all segments of the Jewish community. A funeral procession through the streets of the Lower East Side was planned, with stops at the main Orthodox synagogues where the chief rabbi was to be memorialized. It soon became clear that thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands of mourners planned to participate. Recognizing both the probable enormity of the crowd and the legal requirement to procure a permit for such an event, one of the organizers of the funeral called upon the local police. After receiving permission for the march, he was informed he informed the police official on duty that as many as 20,000 people might participate. He left assured that 25 policemen would be in place the next day, and that more than that would come if needed. On the morning of July 30th, 1902, that morning witnessed a huge funeral procession following the casket of the chief rabbi. Behind it stretched a line of 200 carriages bearing family members, local officials, wealthy merchants, and dozens of prominent rabbis from around the country. Standing before them on both sides of the street stretched a crowd of 50,000 to 100,000 mourners. It's a huge crowd in those days. Weeping, wailing, and chanting of psalms filled the air as the massive entourage made its way to each of the main Orthodox synagogues. The crowd struggled and occasionally surged as particularly zealous mourners sought to touch the casket, but remarkably, no serious incident occurred. 2 hours later, after recitation of the final prayers, the last leg of the march to the ferry at the end of Grand Street, the cemetery was in Queens, he's buried in Union Field in Queens, commenced. Turning east on Grand Street, the procession soon came upon a massive brick factory that housed the famed printing press manufacturing firm R.H. Ho and Company. Now, the people who worked at R.H. Ho had a history of disrupting Jewish funerals. They had a history of this. And now there ensued an unbelievable event. There, unbelievably, a riot began. The chronology of the events that led to this riot is given now. It's presented in stages. Stage one, as the procession began to pass the Ho factory, some workers who had climbed onto the roof or gone to upper story windows to get a better view of the procession started throwing a variety of items, including food, water, oily rags, and pieces of wood and metal at the mourners. Now again, these people are simply marching behind the casket. That's all they are doing. They are not disrupting. They're not doing anything. Stage two, the mourners were outraged, of course. Of course they were outraged at such disrespect for so solemn an occasion. Some of them began throwing the missiles back at those who had tossed them. Others burst into the factory in an effort to stop the assault. Stage three. The first floor office workers were unaware of what was going on outside. Therefore, when the irate mourners, many of them screaming in Yiddish, burst into the first floor of the factory, they panicked. The police were called. In addition, in an attempt to, quote unquote, protect themselves from what appeared to be an unruly mob, they turned on the fire hoses and doused the invaders. Some anti-Semitic remarks were shouted at the mourners, who were quickly expelled from the factory building. Stage four. Meanwhile, out in the street, a general melee ensued. The fire hose was aimed indiscriminately at those outside the building, whether they had been in the building or not. The mourners responded by hurling bricks, rocks, and other items at the Ho building. Most of the building's windows were shattered. However, this situation did not persist for very long. Indeed, the scene outside the factory began to calm down by the time the head of the funeral procession began boarding the ferry to Brooklyn, located a half mile past the factory. And now stage five. Quote, A few minutes later, at 1:20 p.m., a squad of 200 policemen summoned at the outbreak of hostilities by the Ho employees arrived on the scene under the leadership of Inspector Adam A. Cross. Without a word of warning or request to disperse, stated the report on the incident commissioned by the mayor, the police rushed upon the remnant of the gathering, some of them with great roughness of language and violence of manner. In the end, hundreds of people were injured, primarily by the clubs and fists of the policemen. 11 Jews were arrested. 9 were fined between $5 and $10 each and then released. The other 2 were held for $1,000 bail for inciting a riot. Eventually, 4 employees of the Ho Company were also arrested. The entire Jewish community of New York was, of course, outraged. I mean, this was unbelievable. The police were the ones who had really promoted a riot, not the mourners. And charges of anti-Semitism were leveled at the workers of the Ho Company as well as the police. In addition, the police were accused of treating as criminals people whose only crime, quote-unquote, was that they had peacefully participated in the chief rabbi's funeral procession. Protest meetings were organized demanding that Mayor Seth Lowe, who had been elected a year earlier on the pledge to reform the police department, the New York Police Department was known for its corruption, was known for the fact that there were big, big problems. He was to form an investigative committee to look into this incident. Such a committee consisting of notable reformers, including 2 prominent Jews, was indeed formed. It took testimony from many witnesses and issued a comprehensive report. This report condemned the brutal actions of the police in no uncertain terms. The police acted completely improperly. The police commissioner, Colonel Partridge, eventually resigned. 2 officers who had been in charge of the police when the riot occurred also resigned, and a number of others were transferred to precincts that did not include the Lower East Side. That's how the life of Rabbi Jacob Joseph ended. It started off with a huge outpouring of welcome, and it ended off in a huge funeral procession that marked one of the biggest anti-Semitic incidents in America. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. The attempt to establish a chief rabbinate was then abandoned. It was clear that this was something that wasn't going to work. He's resting in something called Union Field, which is in Queens. His grave is people visit his grave at certain times because they feel he was a special man, but nonetheless, his life was a real, real sadness. Came to America with great hopes. There were great hopes that what he would accomplish. He ended up lying for 5 years in bed, completely penniless and forgotten. And then, of course, his funeral was a disaster. Thank you.
What's your evaluation of him as a scholar and a theologian?
He was a brilliant scholar. There's no question about it. He was a brilliant scholar. But that's not what America needed to unify the community. They didn't need a scholar. It's not clear to me, anyway, that the community could have been united because there were too many, you know, disparate views and things like that. There was no way. The idea was to bring all the Jews together. There was no way to bring Reform and the German Jews and the Eastern European Jews under one umbrella that they would be satisfied with. There was no way. So, yeah, he was a great scholar, but I think he took on a position that was simply impossible to fulfill, a mission that was impossible to fulfill. Anyone else?
Yeah, can you say something about your sources?
Yes. Yes. Where do I get this stuff from? Where do I get this stuff from? Okay. Okay. Actually, I almost never go to the library. I don't, okay? Now, there is an organization called the American Jewish Historical Society, which is located in Manhattan. They have a website. There's something called the Publications of the American Jewish Historical Society, which began in 1880-something. And all that is online up until 1978, free and searchable. You can put in Rabbi Jacob Joseph, and it'll pull up every article that was written. Okay? That's number one. Number two, The Stevens Library has been very, very helpful to me when I need certain articles. Say I see a source or something. I bought a book about, there isn't a book about him per se, but there was a book about what's called this Musser movement, which he was part of. And there were some sections on him there. And then when there are references, if I can't get them through American Jewish Historical, if they're not there, then I will email and Leah Kaufman, and now the other woman who runs it,
with a V.
Yes. They're extraordinarily helpful, okay? They're extraordinarily helpful. And they will get me things. They will get me things. So I have this LL account, okay? And they will get me things. So that's where I get a lot of stuff. Also, now Google has a huge number of things on the books, and all the old books, or many of the old books, are downloadable because the copyrights went away. So you can download some of that stuff. And in a certain sense, see, as I think everybody knows, I'm a mathematician. I'm not a historian. I have no qualifications to be a historian. I became interested in American Jewish history, and this has become kind of a fascination for me. And I don't know where it's going to go. I really don't know where it's going to go, and it takes me here and it takes me there. I have contacts at Yeshiva University also, sometimes there and various other places. But I almost never go to the library. It's not. I once went to look for something on the microfiche. I couldn't stand it. To look through that, I mean, my goodness, okay? Now, I recently came across, there's a book by a guy by the name of Bertram Korn, I believe it is, about Jews during the Civil War, which is something I'm interested in. Again, and my focus is on the religious aspects of Jewry. And there was a reference, a guy, first of all, there's a write-up about the Passover Seder, both by Union troops and by Confederate troops, okay? Those two letters are online, but then there was something else by a guy who wrote about the prayers of the Jewish soldiers, and it referred to something called the news called the Israelites, which is from the middle of the 19th century. So I asked the library, I don't know if she'll be able to get it for me or not. So that's where this stuff is coming from primarily. That's where this stuff is coming from.
You say you don't know where it's going. I mean, what do you intend to do with this?
Oh, wait. No. I published four. Oh, I forgot to mention one other source. I will in a second remind you. Okay. I published four articles on Rabbi Jacob Joseph. First of all, I write a monthly column in something called the Jewish Press, which is probably the largest Anglo-Jewish publication in America, called Glimpses into American Jewish History. It appears the first issue of each month. So, for example, the paper that came out today has an article by somebody called Miriam and Abraham Kobe, who were Orthodox Jews who lived in the Midwest. They eventually ended up in Culver City and then in Denver during the 19th century. Okay, and Miriam Kobe was called, she was a midwife, and she was called the Angel of Mercy because of the things that she did. They remained Orthodox. They imported meat from Denver. When it ended up being all spoiled, because it was before refrigeration, they became vegetarians. And then they moved to Denver. Then they moved to Denver. They remained observant. So, but something else I found, okay? You can search the New York Times. Okay, now I don't have a subscription to the New York Times, but you can get at least the outline of the article. And some of them you can actually read online. Others, the library will get for me. Okay, so I wrote my final article about Rabbi Jacob Joseph. Actually, one was a front page article, which was about 2,300 words. And then there were two shorter articles of about 1,300 words. And then the last article was about the character. I found articles in the New York Times online that described what people said about him shortly after he died. And this to me is fascinating stuff. I mean, I have trouble with the paper in the following sense. He doesn't like quotes. Papers don't have quotes, he keeps telling me. But I think that a quote is worth more than me rehashing and changing the words, because it's the real flavor of what happened. So the New York Times also sometimes is a resource. Thank you, folks. Appreciate it.
Right,
yeah, another question.
How do you account for this tremendous funeral that occurred after he died, was there like a collective guilt?
I believe that there was. I believe that there was a collective guilt. I believe that people felt bad. I think most people knew that he had basically been ignored and he was living in poverty, or they knew he wasn't, you know. And I think they felt some sort of guilt, yeah. Yeah, it's the only explanation. I mean, why bother? They had ignored him towards the end of his life, completely ignored him, okay? Let me add something, okay? He had a son, Raphael Joseph, who was one of the main movers in establishing what was called the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, which was the first Orthodox elementary school in the 20th century. It started in 1902. It was the blueprint for traditional Jewish education today, in the sense that there were Hebrew subjects combined with a complete secular education. Raphael Joseph had a son, Lazarus Joseph, who was involved in politics here in New York and was quite high up. And he had a son, Jacob Joseph, who was a captain in the military in World War II, who was killed. And there's a park named the Jacob Joseph Park in Manhattan, interestingly enough. So that's sort of a little footnote. Little footnote. Thank you. Thank you. Oh yeah, what am I? Yeah, all right. I have on my website a chronological listing of all these articles, and I would like to put it into a book. I got to get somebody who's willing to publish it.
Well, we'll invite you a few more times. You'll have more books.
I tell you, when I started to write this series, the editor of the paper asked me, "How many do you think you'll write?" I said, "Maybe 12." I think 48 is going to appear today.
Wow, really?
Yeah, it's a long time. Sir.